The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist, where we deal with everything Russian and Ukrainian, and in particular, our concern is the role of the Orthodox Church, both East and West, in doing battle with the New World Order, the creation of one world government based on corporate capital and banking and corporate exploitation. This, to me, is the political and economic basis and fundament of Antichrist. That is to say, of the complete global domination of those forces hostile to Christ and specifically the Orthodox tradition. Although it's very sad to say that the overwhelming majority of Christians, without realizing it, in their ignorance and the ignorance of their clergy, serve the interests of Antichrist and the New World Order. So that's our mission, and in that regard, we are medievalist, ethnic nationalist, and guild socialist in our general approach. And soon, I will do a show on the political theory of guild socialism, which was a British movement in the 1830s through the 1850s and 60s, and something that Dostoevsky also sympathized with, and is an English movement connected with the Anglo-Catholic resurrection in the 1830s, and the Oxford movement, etc. But today, we're going to deal with two men, living about 100 years apart, maybe a little less, and they are both Slavs, both very different from one another, but almost entirely unknown outside of certain circles in the East. The first is one of the leaders, if not the leader, in the Belarusian intellectual tradition, and that is the almost completely ignored Renaissance figure, Francis Skodnia, who dies in around 1540. And the second is a monk from Mount Athos, who really was only made famous because of a poem written about him by Ivan Franko, and that is Ivan Vyshinsky. Both are fairly radical, although Vyshinsky being by far the most radical. In fact, I'll go so far to say that Vyshinsky is the Ukrainian Savonarola, who we've dealt with on this program some time ago. But they are social radicals. They are nationalists. They are of a sort Platonists. And they're ignored because, from a purely ideological point of view, they really upset the neat categories that historians and philosophers like to place people in, or like to place the history of thought in. And those categories are there deliberately to distort how history is understood. It's been a thesis of this program for some time now that the philosophical establishment, you know, those people who control philosophy departments for a lot of money in the universities, that these guys have deliberately constructed a schema of intellectual history that leaves a lot of people out for the sake of constructing this philosophy of history that all thought from Plato onward leads to them and leads to the conformist institutional liberalism and feminism and leftism that dominate the universities and dominate them with an iron hand. And so I want to deal with these two men because they're almost completely ignored outside of Ukraine and Belarus, because they're extremely interesting, and a lot of what they have to say really upsets the academic university apple cart concerning how they view history, because they're saying things at a time when they're not supposed to be saying it. And one of the great myths that historians have put out in the universities that nationalism as some sort of cultural or social ideology only came into existence in the 19th century. And of course, that's laughable. There was tremendous nationalism in the Roman Empire. There was certainly nationalism in Greece, in ancient Greece, and they viewed all non-Greeks as barbarians. There's always been nationalism in China in the ancient world. Certainly a well-developed national sense in medieval Ireland and Scotland. The development of unified British church under Theodore of Tarsus and under monarchs like Edgar and before him Alfred. You know, nationalism and the concept of this cultural unity is as old as history. And it's typical, you know, how fraudulent the academics are in that they'll use words like nation and state equivocally. And they'll say that, yes, all of that is true, but when we say nationalism, we mean the politicized state. And I say, well, that's dishonest. That's not what we're talking about. When we talk about nationalism, we're referring to ethnic or religious or racial consciousness relative to hostile outsiders, but dedicated largely to the internal development of the population. That's what we're talking about. And we've dealt with this on this show. And so these two men are ignored, and they're ignored for a reason. And a lot of what we do on this show is resurrect some of these people who are no longer read, but, you know, they're not being read for a very good reason. And the academic establishment actively goes out of their way to suppress those writers and figures who say things that they're not supposed to say. So, in other words, it's a retroactive political correctness that's imposed on history. Their obsession with control and bureaucratic dominance is so out of control and pathological that they believe that they not only have the right but the duty to suppress those historical figures that they can control and manipulate. For those people who are too major to control, they simply will rewrite them. Anyway, Belarus and Francis Skarnia. Skarnia is a major Renaissance figure who is largely written out of the Renaissance by experts in that topic. What makes him interesting is that he is from Belarus. He's from Polak. And he's educated in Western Europe. And he has three things that make him worthwhile. And these three things, when you spell it all out, has made him sort of the national philosopher of Belarus, and that he held to the vernacular languages for all people. You know, this is in the turn of the 16th century here, saying that people should be organized and united according to the common language, that the cultural traditions of a people are to be found in their folklore, and that the highest expression of the Western mind has been in the Middle Ages. Of course, most of the time, none of these things are held by the average Renaissance figure. And this is why Skarnia has been largely whited out of the textbooks. The very fact that he's talking about the sort of the formal quality of the vernacular language, and then the content, namely the folklore and the traditions of the common people, that this should be the basis of politics, that wasn't supposed to be done until the 19th century. So here you have a man doing it who dies in 1540, who, although educated in Renaissance Europe, confronted many of the assumptions that he saw within that education. And I think you're going to see, both with Skarnia and with Vyshensky, that they share a lot with Savonarola. National self-awareness is something that he makes central. He is a medievalist, but like the later Ukrainian writers and historians of the 19th century, people like Kulish and Rahmanov, and Maximovich, folklore is the heart of a people. Folklore is intensely connected with democracy. Democracy not as just, you know, registering a temporary preference, but democracy as getting to the content of what makes a people. Democracy as representation, which is not what modern democracy refers to. Modern democracy is purely the imposition of an ideology upon a people, usually by American bayonets and the money of George Soros. But in a true sense, in the sense that Scania was writing in the 1510s and 1520s, that folklore is the collective expression of the common people and is therefore immensely important. It represents the collective will over time of a population. Scania is a Platonist, and he views the world aesthetically. He views the world as more or less beautiful reflections of the heavenly forms that you read about in Plato and the Neoplatonics. And that beauty on earth, whether it be in terms of folk art or natural beauty, these are reflective of the order that already exists in the divine mind. Scania has is a tremendous Platonist, and he sees the divine ideas manifest in his particular definition of beauty, which is the harmonization and the integralization of culture, national life, nature, and the individual. True beauty is therefore social. When all of these things can be harmonized in a singular ethnic or cultural or linguistic unity, that is true beauty, because it unites all specifically social beautiful things. It's absolutely central to everything that he is. And like a lot of people at the time, he is interested in the old Byzantine concept of iconography, because it's really one and the same thing. To put it very simply, the purpose of an icon done in the Byzantine tradition is to show in some limited way what a truly resurrected and spiritualized matter would be like. So culture, national life, nature, and the individual. All of these are brought together in a singular unity within the icon. The icon is meant to show what someone would look like if they were spiritualized. What man looked like in the Garden of Eden. What man will look like after the general resurrection. That's the point of the icon. Now, of course, that's impossible to do. And yet the iconographer is supposed to come as close as humanly possible to that idea. During the Renaissance, what developed in the West was a very fleshy, what was a very earthbound kind of painting, although, you know, not without its spiritual significance. I don't want to be fundamentalist in that regard. I'm just saying that compared to the mentality of the icon, the paintings of Raphael were on the opposite side of that spectrum. And to a great extent, many of the Orthodox countries, although eventually importing some of that stuff, the church, at least for a while, tried to resist some of that stuff because it did not show the transformation of matter, which is the central and Platonic concept of the icon. All in good Platonist tradition, all things existing in nature are symbolic. They're symbolic because they're pieces of a broader whole. The entire cosmos is a single living being manifest by logos. This is classic patristic logos theology and Platonism. Therefore, if you have something that is beautiful in the way that we have described it, it is therefore true. And truth is to be found in those ideas or those institutions or those ways of life that can integrate culture, national life, nature, and person in a single entity. Therefore, the redeemed man, the man who's truly redeemed in the best Christian sense of the term, is someone who has succeeded in doing this. So truth is beauty, but beauty is defined in that way. But Scotinius says that talking like this can get you into a lot of trouble. Talking like this, rejecting the interests of the powerful, is something that's really only reserved for a few. And he points to the book of Job, where in telling the truth, that's how you end up. You will lose everything if you express yourself in this kind of a way. Because this sort of a mentality is destructive in the same sense that Savonarola was destructive as far as the Medici banking houses were concerned. And Savonarola, as you know, was burned at the stake, not because he said anything that was heretical or problematic, but that he confronted what the Renaissance was really all about, that is the resurrection of the pagan banking houses. Remember, in ancient Greece, the temples were all banks. That's why these temples were knocked to the ground. Not because they cared about paganism, that's where all their money was. The temples were banks. The worship of Baal and the worship of the Greco-Roman gods was tightly connected with political power and financial power. So when Socrates denied the existence of the pagan gods, he created a run on the banks. And that's one of the real reasons that he was put to death. And it was no different with Christ's confrontation with the Jewish Pharisees. It's that same obsession with pride of place and money. But Scotinia, for all of his social radicalism, never held that a real ethical system can be a closed system. For him, serving God on earth is to some extent reducible to philanthropy. But by philanthropy, he means the building of local, integrated, democratic structures in the best sense of the word, the complete forgetfulness of self within those other entities that create the beautiful thing. He recognizes the normative need for the creation of nations based on language and national customs. And the reason that he's opposed to ethics as a system is because our particular local or ethnic concept is limited by that particular group's experience. And therefore, given our natural differences, nation from nation, race from race, we are going to naturally organize ourselves this way, but as a result, we will be fairly limited in what we know. There is no such thing as a global view. It is simply too broad, and in our contemporary time is tightly controlled by the major banking houses and corporations. So the global view is nothing more than the view of the New World Order. But he's looking to a natural economy in the same sense that Savonarola was. And so in building Sabuna Pravanaya, in building this representative local ethnic structure, this was the very heart of the ascetic life, the forgetfulness of self. Virtue and happiness, as a result of all of that, is strictly social. It's never personal, because your personhood is something that is constructed by the social world around you. We can reflect on that, but our ability to criticize it is limited. It's limited by language, it's limited by our general social customs, and while it's our reason that makes us human, that reason is limited to that particular horizon. The public, that localized public, is manifest by this integration and what sounds an awful lot like Rousseau's general will. I don't want to exaggerate that. But this is about service to the public good, which is identical to your private good. And therefore, it is the general will, in Rousseau's sense, And of course, this is written long before Rousseau was alive, but a very similar concept develops in Scotigny's work. But for him, the common good could only be national. It could only be based on the specific circumstances and historical experience of a people. And so for him, that love and devotion to your people and to that locality is something else that makes us truly human. But that love is identical to faith. Faith and love are the same thing. The main element, therefore, of moral behavior is this kind of integration, that forgetfulness of self, that solidarity on this basis requires. And it's the local laws, the ancient laws of the people that should be followed. He was a nationalist and a royalist. The monarch is a symbol of the nation and is only legitimate because he is a symbol of the nation. He is not some radical equalitarian. He does believe that some kind of class society is absolutely inevitable. We are not identical people. But the alienation that comes from that intense, like we have in our postmodern world, where the overwhelming majority of the wealth that we as workers create is controlled by a tiny handful of people who hate us. For Scotigny, that kind of alienation is not inevitable. And again, this is something that you can see in Savonarola. So in kind of a Rousseauian representative way, social democracy in that regard becomes the political view of Scotigny. And a real patriotism, a real nationalism in his world is ethnic. And that the religion of the people must be a part of the ethnic structures, because that's the way that the religion is communicated to the population. So the simple concept is that Scotigny is saying things that he certainly is not supposed to be saying in the 1520s and even before then. And so there is every reason to hold that this man is sort of the other side to the Renaissance, and certainly has more in common with Savonarola than he does with the Renaissance in Florence, which almost to a man was financed by the Medici banks. So we're going to move up about 100 years in history when we come back, and we're going to deal with a similar, although more radical, critique of the modern Eastern European world from Ivan Vyshensky of Mount Athos.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We are talking about two people. The first half of this show, we talked about Francis Scotigny of Belarus, and now going to talk about an Athenite monk named Ivan Vyshensky, made famous in a much later poem by Ivan Franko. And I think if it wasn't for Franko writing about him, not a whole lot of people would have heard of this man. I want to say that Vyshinsky is more like Savonarola than Skarnia, and in the simple sense that he is probably the most radical figure of his age. And I want to say that the one way to understand Vyshinsky and his approach to social criticism is that he essentially wants to bring the Athenite monastic ethos back to Ukraine where he came from. It is a political monasticism, and his condemnation of, now he dies in 1640, he dies right before the rebellion of Khmelnytsky, and so what he's looking at is the Polish aristocratic and oligarchic domination of Ukraine, and the growth of royal absolutism in the Muscovite Empire at the same time. So, Vyshinsky is looking at Ukraine at a time of tremendous revolution. The Union of Poland and Lithuania has permitted the Poles to colonize great sections of Western Ukraine and Volhynia. And the result is that the Orthodox Church was banned, and the Polish magnates and the Jews that they hired to run their estates and to control the cities were in complete control of the countryside. The Ukrainian peasant under Polish control lived in extreme poverty, but more than that, the Orthodox Church and the Ruthenian language or the Ukrainian language was viewed as something that only the ignorant would ever use. And the system has always been like this. When you want to oppress somebody, the first thing you got to do is dehumanize them. And in America right now, that's being done by the Jewish media to the white working class. And I don't have a TV, thank God, but, you know, when I do see it, my mother's house, my sister's house, and I'm flipping through the channels, it's about every 10 minutes I hear a reference to the cracker, to the white trash, to the redneck, to the trailer park, and the purpose, of course, is to totally dehumanize the white working class so that their wages can be continuously lowered and that they could be sunk more and more into the world of NASCAR and alcoholism and drugs and suicide. The overwhelming majority of American suicides are white males. But this is normal. The Soviets did the exact same thing relative to the Orthodox peasant. They were ignorant. They were rubes, and therefore it made it easy to destroy them. When Cromwell murdered tens of thousands of Irishmen during the so-called British Revolution, he said that these were heretics. These were Catholics, and of course we, as true followers of Israel, we are the true faith, and therefore these ignorant slaves can be exterminated. And it's no accident that Cromwell had enslaved large numbers of Irishmen both in Australia and in the Caribbean. So this is a similar thing as far as the Polish-Jewish oligarchy in Ukraine. At the time that Vyshinsky is writing, and he had visited the country and in disgust had gone back to Mount Athos in Greece. So, you know, it's a fairly radical point of view. He thinks that humanity, especially when they're gathered into a national matrix, that human beings are equal to one another. At the very least, they're equal in a legal sense. Remember, back then, the only people who had rights were the Polish magnates, not the Polish people as a whole, of course, but just the Polish magnates and the Jews. These were the only two groups of people that had rights at all. And so rights were connected to your social class. And Vyshinsky violently reacts to this, saying all men are equal, and that this sort of aristocratic title, and that title, rather than your ability, giving you access to power, is outrageous and immoral. And at the time, whether you were Catholic or Orthodox, It's these aristocratic clans that controlled the church. They owned the churches. They picked the priest. They were heavily involved in consecrating bishops, or at the very least choosing which bishop was to be consecrated. They controlled the monasteries. In fact, calling it a Christian society at all, although in this case certainly not the fault of the Ukrainian peasant, is simply wrong. It was a purely aristocratic society, and these aristocratic clans controlled the church for their own purposes. He attacks the bishops, again, whether they be Orthodox or Catholic, in this area because they have been so debased and brutalized, and what they really are secular lords. They may call themselves bishops, they may dress up in bishops' robes, but that doesn't make them such. Their behavior is purely secular and no different from the Jews in that particular respect. Now, the bishops, especially the Catholic Poles, were not engaging in charity work. They were not doing what they were supposed to do. They were evil men. They were gluttonous. They cared about power and money and their pomp and everything else. And he made no bones about condemning anyone and everyone who abused his office that way. And of course, in Vyshensky's mind, that was endemic. In fact, it was intrinsic to the nature of the social system itself. So that's no different than Savonarola's condemnation of the Medici cult and its paganism. For Vyshensky, this is the very political expression of paganism. But at its best, the church is meant to be, outside of its obvious spiritual role, is the bearer of culture and morality, and as he sees it in the Polish Commonwealth, it is the very opposite. That the bishops and the abbots are little more than politicians. And they're not chosen based on their holiness or on their intelligence or on their work or anything else. They are chosen and consecrated based exclusively on their political contacts. But Vyshensky says one of the reasons he became a monk and as a result had to leave the country was that monasticism for him was the eternal protest against those people that made their living off the labor of others. For him, the Jew and the Polish nobleman in the countryside, that was their whole life. Their whole world was simply to live as a parasite. And monasticism, where everyone has to work, where everyone has a job to do, and it's a basically democratic and more or less egalitarian society at its best, this is a protest. In fact, the monastery is to some limited extent a utopian experiment that exists to confront the lords and nobles of the world. When he talks about political government, he says, don't you understand? Rule is not something that you want. Rule means that the choices that you make have long-term effects, can affect people for generations. It's a terrible moral burden, and precisely those people who are scrambling to gain some kind of rule or power, the very fact that they're scrambling for it means that they're the last people who should have it. Rule is something that is difficult. The only legitimate rulership at all, and of course, again, he's taking from the monastic mentality, it is only based on service and sacrifice. In Christ's time, the apostles are arguing who is going to be greatest, which apostle is going to be leader, and Christ shuts them up and says, whoever will be the greatest among you must, as a result of that, be the servant of all. So there, Christ completely rejects this concept of rule over and above society or the church. To be a ruler is to rule by example, to work and sacrifice yourself for the sake of the common good, and to forget about yourself in the process. Only those people have any kind of moral legitimacy whatsoever. Vyshensky, for all of his ability, claim to be a simpleton. He says, I don't really know much, and I'm speaking in the language of the common people. I'm speaking in simple Ukrainian, the language of the peasant, of the ignorant, as you would call them. And yet, Christ was the wise simpleton. Christ wasn't a part of any establishment, and yet he was able to confront the Pharisees of his day and defeat them in debate. Why? Because Christ was free and they were not. They were enslaved to an establishment. That establishment gave them their positions and their money and their prestige, and therefore their whole world surrounded revolved around the exploitation of others and the constant justification of their position. Christ, not having any of those attachments, he was capable of directly confronting anyone and everyone, having in essence nothing to lose because he was homeless. But that is the realm of real criticism. To have no attachments and to be able to see the social system, not from the inside, it can only be a distorted picture from the inside, but from the outside. And then we see what the social system is precisely because we're not a part of it. All relationships, whether it be the family or the church or government, have to be based on the famous Russian word pravda. Pravda doesn't just mean right in the sense of political right or in the sense of being correct and having the truth, but that automatically is just and in fact justice itself. The truth that leads to justice, or in fact, the truth that is justice, that is the nature of all relationships. And it doesn't make any difference what the nature of the relationship is. Unless truth and justice are there, the relationship is based on fraud and parasitism. What he says ultimately is that our ruin, whether it be Ukrainians who are suffering under foreign occupation, or the average Polish person who is suffering under the rule of his own ethnic group, although they did speak Latin rather than Polish, it is greed, the desire for money, for power, for prestige. This is what destroys us, and therefore the monastic ascetic mentality and the forgetfulness of self must be at the center. It's no accident that Vyshinsky, when he was in Ukraine, was close to the Brotherhood of Lvov in the western part of the country, and the Orthodox Brotherhood movement, which we've dealt with on this program, is something that he thought might be a vehicle for regeneration of society. Ultimately, you know, he says that people are leaving the church because they have been paganized, and they've been paganized by the church itself in these countries, because the church only seems to care about money. When I say the church, I mean the bishops and the abbots and the important people. And so it seems that the only real reality, therefore, is material, money, cash, and everything that you could buy with it. And therefore, simplicity is the highest state of social health. It goes for the family, for the church, for the society as a whole. To control what you want, to limit your wants and connect them tightly to what it is that you need. Anything extraneous is too much. Anything extraneous is corrupting. It ties you to the world and it ties you to the regime. And it's not just a sin, but it institutionalizes this sin. So for him, you know, when he wrote, it was this intense literary realism. He loved to depict the arrogant bishop, or the arrogant abbot, or the arrogant lord ruling over his subjects that he viewed as little more than cattle. And he did write in the common language, and that was no accident. He knew that the very fact that, for example, the Polish nobles spoke Latin, it meant that in many ways they were a different ethnic group than the peasants who spoke Western Slavic or Polish. That's no accident. It was a way that they could separate themselves from the common herd that they hated. Ultimately, the idea of subliminal pravna that we've dealt with on this show many, many times is central to justice. The idea of democracy as representation, to represent the religious and political tradition of a particular ethnic group, not necessarily the mechanistic concept of registering a vote once in a while. Because ultimately, the only function of law, and I've intimated this already, the only function of law is justice. Unless a law helps create a more just society, it has no reason to exist. And of course, he's looking at the law of the Commonwealth and he's saying, most of this is about protecting you and your friends, not about the people as a whole. And really, you know, he condemns the Union. When I say the Union, I'm referring to the 1596 Uniate movement, where the Vatican had, the Polish government was kind of iffy about this, had forced certain peasants to become Catholic, but to fool them by permitting them to use the Orthodox ritual. And it was done by force. It was done under the pressure of the Polish army. And the Polish army was strictly an aristocratic army under the local lords. And he said the only reason that people would go for that is because the lords and the Vatican and the Church of Rome has so much more money than us simple Orthodox. It's really about this kind of prestige. Everything that you guys do is about this fakery, this prestige, this money, and the so-called Catholic Unia. And it still exists today in the so-called Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church. Greek Catholic used to refer to Orthodox people, so those people have no right to that phrase. They're Uniates. An Orthodox person is a Greek Catholic person as opposed to a Roman Catholic person. There is no such thing as an Orthodox Christian. That's a misnomer and a neologism. It is Orthodox or Greek Catholic versus a Roman Catholic, or among the Anglicans, an Anglo-Catholic. The point is that heresy, schism, apostasy, warfare, all of this stuff is based on the worship of money and power. That really the fact is that the Christian life, especially in its monastic expression, which is its highest expression, is absolutely incompatible with this radical legal inequality. It's not just an inequality of income. That's probably normal. We're talking about the fact that only a certain class of people can legally press their claim in court. That kind of, that sort of institutionalized inequality, and that lordship and serfdom in its Polish and Russian form is based on, that is absolutely totally incompatible with the Christian message. And it doesn't make any difference what particular group you're in. It is completely incompatible with it. You can't claim to be a Christian society and then yet permit the nobles to own other people. That doesn't work. Ultimately, he is challenging the complete secularization, in his mind, of the hierarchy in Poland, Lithuania, Ukraine. Ultimately, the nobles exist and serve to oppress others and to gratify themselves, and so their entire institution is based on sin and self-worship. Now, coming from all of this, Wyszynski holds a fairly radical dualistic view, at least in our present fallen world, of the relationship between soul and body. And he's one of these guys that holds that really the central concept of the Christian life is the suppression of bodily desires. Not just so that you can liberate the spirit, not just so you could liberate the mind from the chains of the secular world, but only by suppressing those drives can society be saved from its current state, a state based on greed, self-worship and the worship of matter, the worship of material things, and that somehow our life can come out of death, that life can come out of something that isn't life, which is a contradiction and is central to Gnosticism, evolutionism, capitalism, socialism, and all of the isms of the modern world. Politically speaking, the union of Lublin between Lithuania and Poland gave the aristocracy, specifically in Poland, the green light to get more and more arrogant, because now they had a much larger state to fight their opponents. And that union permitted the Polish nobles to take more and more land, to oppress more and more people, including their own people. And of course, this constant Jewish-Polish alliance that was such a central marker of the so-called Commonwealth state in this particular period of time. Spirit and matter. I mean, he's looking at the practical results of self-indulgence. And he's saying spirit and matter are clearly at war. And as I'm looking at Ukraine here in, say, 1630, 1620, what I'm seeing is the victory of matter, the victory of matter over all things. Spirit is connected with reason, freedom, and rationality. Matter cannot be, because matter is neither free nor rational. It is simply this dead hunk of nothing. That's what matter really is. And so humanity has a choice. Do you want to suppress matter to liberate the spirit, or to suppress spirit and worship matter? The one leads to freedom, the other leads to serfdom. That's precisely his ultimate political point. And the way, and to conclude this, the way he kind of schematizes his monastic rebellion against modern society, that materialism must give way to asceticism, because there's got to be a point at which people see that what glitters in the material world can never satisfy, at least can never satisfy a sensitive man. If greed is a problem, if force and warfare is a problem, the only solution is to repress those parts of humanity that demand this constant self-promotion. And this asceticism leads to purification and the rejection of the world being defined as those forces that worship matter, and finally lead to inner peace and quiet, or in the Greek, Hezekiah. The concept is that the world can never bring peace. That these nobles that are constantly doing everything in their power to get more and more serfs, to gain more and more land, to engage in more and more warfare, you're always going to come up against others. You're always going to end up fighting others. Your interests are completely different from those around you who are doing the same thing, and certainly are opposed to those peasants who you force to work for your luxuries. It is self-contradictory, and it is irrational. Materialism is self-contradictory and irrational. Therefore, eventually, even the most committed materialist is going to have to look at himself, and the very fact that he can look at himself suggests that spirit and freedom exists in the world. But he's going to have to look at himself and ask himself, what really satisfies me? Is it just the gaining of money and power? And to what end am I gaining money and power? And usually to gain money and power. Ultimately, asceticism, simplicity, the limitation of wants, the limitation of needs, the deliberate narrowing of your focus for the sake of peace, not just external peace, but inner peace, is going to have to derive from the warfare and the savagery of this era. This is exactly what Savonarola said to the Medicis. The Medicis and those close to them recreated the world in the image of Greco-Roman paganism. That was the whole point of the Renaissance. This is why the Medicis financed every aspect of the Renaissance, at least in Italy. So, Leshensky is very much a Greco-Ukrainian Savonarola, and his critique is radical because the perversion of the oligarchy was radical. The oppression that he saw was radical. But the fact that serfdom and materialism and the ownership of one man by another is or as completely incompatible with Orthodox teaching is at the center of everything. And so he will then go on to condemn the social system of Russia, although at this time, you know, serfdom had not fully developed in Russia. And it's a reason why this man with his greatness has never been canonized, because he was simply too radical. We could say the same of the Catholics relative to Savonarola. Holy, no question. Completely driven by the gospel, no question. And both these men, you have the same thing. And yet they've been, Savonarola was a little bit too big to push under the bed, but Leshensky was not. And Skarnia was not. And I think with these two men, you have a very early expression of a social radicalism based on ethnic and religious solidarity. And that's what makes them significant, and that's what makes them important for this fight against Antichrist in the New World Order. So I thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.